From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today is World AIDS Day. Gay men have been hit hard by the epidemic. Gay writers have chronicled the catastrophe. On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear some of the extraordinary poems that have been written through the epidemic about illness and loss. We'll also hear from an editor who's helped shape the literature of AIDS and has worked with many writers who have died of AIDS. And we'll hear an AIDS prayer written and read by Tony Kushner, whose Pulitzer Prize-winning play Angels in America ends its Broadway run this weekend. The music we're listening to, God is Our Righteousness, was composed by Chris de Blasio, who died of AIDS last year. AIDS literature coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. President Clinton has announced a new initiative that he said would help strengthen U.S. military readiness and help armed forces personnel and their families. The president said he'll ask Congress for $25 billion more dollars for the Pentagon over the next 6 years, including a pay raise for military staff. The president noted that U.S. troops have been under great burdens in recent years, with humanitarian operations in Rwanda, Haiti, and elsewhere, and the quick deployment to the Persian Gulf earlier this year. The U.S. Senate continues to debate the global trade accord known as GATT and appears likely to approve the accord. Speaking from the Senate floor, New Jersey Democrat Bill Bradley urged his colleagues to support GATT. He said the U.S. has to adapt to a changing world.
Our vote is an indication of how we will react to change. We can seize it and shape it to our advantage. That's the response of a self-confident, vigorous nation, and that is the traditional American response. Or we can put our heads in the sand and in the vain hope that change will pass us by.
This morning, President Clinton held a breakfast for a group of undecided senators. According to one, the president told lawmakers if the treaty fails, they'd regret it for the rest of their lives. Treaty opponents charge GATT will cost the U.S. its sovereignty and could mean a loss of American jobs to low-wage countries. Mexico has a new president. Ernesto Zedillo was sworn in a few hours ago. The 42-year-old economist promised to continue political and economic reforms in Mexico. Among those at the inauguration today were Vice President Al Gore and Cuban President Fidel Castro. About a mile from the ceremony, 4,000 people protested against Zedillo. Most of the demonstrators were farmers and supporters of the opposition Democratic Revolution Party. The federal government wants Iowa farmers and their spouses to volunteer for a study into possible connections between pesticide use and certain illnesses. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports.
The helicopter, operated by Midwest MedFlight, crashed just a few miles from St. Joseph Mercy Hospital. It was on its way to pick up a patient from another hospital in the town of Howell, about 30 miles away. On board were the pilot, a physician, and a nurse. Authorities say they believe all three were killed immediately upon impact. The pilot signaled Mayday just before the crash. Some witnesses reported seeing billowing smoke coming from the tail of the helicopter as it went down. Officials are investigating the crash site. They say it appears as though the pilot was attempting to make an emergency landing. A police officer on the scene says it's likely that there was some sort of a mechanical problem. The weather was clear at the time of the accident. This is Don Gagne in Detroit.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 36.68 at 3702.55 in heavy trading of 279 million shares. This is NPR News. Secretary of State Warren Christopher says the U.S. agrees with its NATO allies on what to do about the Bosnian civil war. At a NATO meeting in Brussels today, Christopher said the Clinton administration supports the position that diplomacy, not force, is the best way to handle the war. U.N. officials say Bosnian Serb forces have taken 7 more U.N. peacekeepers hostage and that more than 400 U.N. soldiers are now in Serb hands. A spokesman says Serb units today crossed into Croatia and took control of a U.N. observation point, capturing 7 peacekeepers in the process. The federal government wants Iowa farmers and their spouses to volunteer for a $15 million study into possible connections between pesticide use and certain illnesses. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports.
The study is aimed at uncovering mysterious links between farming and certain types of cancer, infertility, and childhood diseases. The Iowa Department of Agriculture is trying to recruit farmers from a list of thousands of certified private and commercial pesticide applicators. Farmers have come under increased scrutiny for their pesticide use in recent years, and there's a constant battle between agricultural interests and environmentalists who claim pesticides and other farm chemicals pollute drinking water. Officials say they need at least 50,000 farmers to make the results of the study valid. So far, they have only about 16,000. One of the lead investigators for the study says enough men are enrolling, but their wives, for whatever reason, are not going with them. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
President Clinton has named outgoing Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell as special envoy to Northern Ireland. The president said Mitchell will promote economic initiatives in the region. Mr. Clinton said Mitchell's appointment comes at a historic time with good prospects for peace after 25 years of fighting. The president also praised Britain's decision today to hold talks with Sinn Féin, the IRA's political wing. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today is World AIDS Day, a day to educate about the epidemic and to remember the people we lost to it. The writer John Preston, who died of AIDS this year, once said, "AIDS is not a gay disease. It is, however, a catastrophe for gay men." This catastrophe is being chronicled in a growing body of AIDS literature. Some of it is quite extraordinary. As literary editor Michael Denneny has said, the writers took on the job of sounding the alarm, mobilizing the community politically and spiritually, and delineating the shape of the disaster. Today we'll hear from some of the poets who have found words for the grief and anger that have left so many of us dumbstruck. Poet Mark Doty lost his lover Wally to AIDS 9 months ago. They were together 12 years. Doty is writing about their relationship in a forthcoming book of poems called Atlantis and in a memoir. Doty's latest book of poems, My Alexandria, won a 1994 National Book Critics Circle Award and was a National Book Award finalist. Doty told me that during the last year of Wally's life, he had a viral brain infection, which gradually paralyzed him below the waist.
Every few weeks, there would be something new that Wally couldn't do. Until quite late in his life, he would have trouble finding the word that he wanted, and after a while he was unable to feed himself. Each of these new limitations would mean a new level of loss. I came to feel that losing him was not an event exactly, not a moment, not a line to be crossed, but rather a gradual process.
You have a poem called New Dog about getting a dog for Wally when he was sick. Would you read the poem to us? But before you do, I think this is a new poem.
It is. It's one of the poems of this group that I found myself unable to write during Wally's life. And it was really only about 6 months later that I could see that the sequence I had written felt unfinished, felt unresolved to me. And what was missing was the kind of gesture toward life, towards ongoingness that he had made at a very late point in his life when just about a month before he died, he got very excited about adopting a new dog. Jimmy and Tony can't keep Dino, their cocker spaniel. Tony's too sick. The daily walks, more pressure than pleasure. One more obligation that can't be met. And though we already have a dog, Wally wants to adopt, wants something small and golden to sleep next to him and lick his face. He's paralyzed now from the waist down. Whatever's ruining him, moving upward, and we don't know how much longer he'll be able to pet a dog. How many men want another attachment? Just as they're leaving the world. Wally sits up nights and says, "I'd like some lizards, a talking bird, some fish, a little rat." So after I drive to Jimmy and Tony's in the village and they meet me at the door and say, "We can't go through with it, we can't give up our dog," I drive to the shelter just to look, and there is Bo, bounding and practically boundless. One brass concatenation of tongue and tail, unmediated energy, too big, wild, perfect. He not only licks Wally's face, but bathes every irreplaceable inch of his head. And though Wally can no longer feed himself, he can lift his hand and bring it to rest on the rough gilt flanks when they are, for a moment, still. I have never seen a touch so deliberate. It isn't about grasping. The hand itself seems almost blurred now, softened, though tentative only because so much will must be summoned, such attention brought to the work, which is all he is now. This gesture toward the restless splendor, the unruly, the golden, the animal, the new.
Mark, where is the dog now?
Well, Bo's with me. At the time, I thought, well, we're doing something here that is a little bit crazy. There's a man in the house who's terminally ill, and of course his care was tremendously demanding. And it really did not seem like a reasonable time to adopt a 3-year-old golden retriever who was not particularly well-trained. And what happened after Wally's death was that I discovered that Bo was, in fact, Wally's last gift to me because he became a wonderful presence in my life. A source of energy, a source of surprise, something to get me out of the house at times when I really didn't want to go, a set of needs that I could meet at a time when Wally was no longer there to have his needs met, and I didn't feel I could particularly pay a lot of attention to my own or even be clear about what my needs were. There was a dog to walk and a dog to feed and a presence who needed my attention, and that was very important in getting me through a difficult time.
Did you ever have a sense of what you should be feeling and what you should be writing, only to find that you were feeling and writing things that were completely different?
Oh, sometimes I felt a kind of anger, a kind of helplessness welling up when I would sit down to write, which I did not want to confront. It seemed so necessary during Wally's illness to find ways to be in control, to find ways to manage, both to meet his needs, to deal with the many other people who were suddenly involved in our lives and in our home working to take care of him. And I felt I needed to be able to hold all that together at a time when I also very much needed to fall apart. And because writing is always an invitation to feeling, I would find that when I sat down to do my own work, I would often begin to unravel in a way that I didn't want to face. I think that's why for a long time I couldn't finish these poems. They would threaten to completely overwhelm me.
I'm going to ask you to read another poem. This is a poem about death. But I guess from the title, which is Bill's story, that this is not your story.
That's right.
This is told from somebody else's point of view. I'm not even sure it's about AIDS. So tell us something about whose story this is.
This poem is the story of a friend of mine who lost his sister to the epidemic very early on, early in the 80s, at a point when, of course, we knew even less than the little that we know today. So Annie experienced a sudden and wildly deepening episode of dementia, which at that point was completely not understood. The poem wants to tell Bill's story about the end of his sister's life and also wants to think about the way that we conceive dying, the kind of I'm afraid sometimes all too convenient or easy ways we think about going into the light, the way we think about the experience of death, and how we as the living, as the caregivers, might assist in that, which I think sometimes becomes a little too simple. Towards the end of Wally's life, one of his nurses gave us a Xeroxed handout called How to Prepare for Approaching Death. And as well-meaning as that gesture was, it also completely shocked me to, in its kind of pomposity, you know, the notion that that someone understood what approaching death was like and the ways that we might prepare for it, as opposed to honoring the immensity, the unknowability of the mystery that confronted us. So I think that kind of concern is at the heart of this poem. It's also sometimes, too, you know, a wonderful escape to leave one's own voice behind and at least pretend to speak in someone else's. So this is called Bill's Story. When my sister came back from Africa, we didn't know at first how everything had changed. After a while, Annie bought men's and boys' clothes in all sizes and filled her closets with little or huge things she could never wear. Then she took to buying out theatrical shops, rental places on the skids, sweeping in and saying, "I'll take everything." Dementia was the first sign of something we didn't even have a name for in 1978. She was just growing stranger. All those clothes, the way she'd dress me up when I came to visit. It was like we could go back to playing together again and get it right. She was a performance artist, and she did her best work then, taking the clothes to clubs, talking, putting them all on, talking. It was years before she was in the hospital, and my mother needed something to hold on to, some way to be helpful. So she read a book called Deathing, a cheap, ugly verb if ever I heard one, and took its advice to heart. She'd sit by the bed and say, "Annie, look for the light. Look for the light." It was plain that Anne did not wish to be distracted by these instructions. She came to, though she was nearly gone then, and looked at our mother with what was almost certainly annoyance. "It's a white light," Mom said, and this struck me as incredibly presumptuous, as if the light we'd all go into would be just the same. Maybe she wanted to give herself up to indigo or red. If we can barely even speak to each other, living so separately, how can we all die the same? I used to take the train to the hospital, and sometimes the only empty seats would be the ones that faced backwards. I'd sit there and watch where I'd been waver and blur out, and finally I liked it, seeing what you've left get more beautiful, less specific. Maybe her light was all that gabardine and flannel, khaki and navy and silks and stripes. If you take everything, you've got to let everything go. Dying must take more attention than I ever imagined. Just when she'd compose herself and seem fixed on the work before her, Mother would fret, trying to help her just one more time, look for the light. Until I took my mother's arm and told her wherever I was in the world, I would come back, no matter how difficult it was to reach her, if I heard her calling. "Shut up, Mother," I said, and Annie died.
That's a really powerful poem about not following the rule book.
Thank you. It's hard for me to be sure now how much of that poem is really Bill's story and how much is my elaboration upon his story. I know that the imagination gets a hold of anyone's material and does with it what it will.
Were you with Wally when he died?
Yes, I was.
And did you feel like, "Well, I know what to do, I'll just do what I do," or were you fretting about what to do?
It during the last month, it became clear that there was not a great deal of time left for Wally, at least not a great deal of time for him to be conscious. My great fear for him was that his paralysis would result in being, physically completely immobilized, but nonetheless aware, which did not happen. During the last few weeks, he was like a person who's had a stroke. Part of his body, half of his body, would not cooperate. He couldn't find the words he wanted. And during the last week, as his breathing began to change and as a kind of, I don't know what to call it, a kind of sort of gentle, muffled ease began to settle over him. It was clear to me what was happening. And that last week was a very important time for us together. One of his nurses had wanted him to begin a rather large dose of morphine right around that time, I think on the theory that morphine makes it easier for people to die and certainly can make it easier for the people around the dying person to deal with what's happening. But he wasn't in pain, or at least in no pain that he was expressing. And there was a kind of tranquility and ease in his face that made me want to resist that prescription. And I'm so glad that I did, because it meant that he and I had a week together that was a time of sitting together quietly, and sometimes I was reading and sometimes just looking at him, playing music for him that he liked, spending time with both the dogs, even the impossibly obstreperous new golden retriever, having the cats on the hospital bed with him that we had brought into our room, just being quiet together. He would sleep during the day. He would wake up and chatter or say nothing. He would laugh at his own inability to find the words that he wanted. He would ramble a little, and sometimes he would just lie very quietly. That time also meant that his mother and some of his brothers and sisters were able to see him before he died. And over the last 2 days, when his breathing changed very dramatically and it became clear that it was dying, that he was dying, it meant that the two of us could sit together and I could pay attention to that. It meant that when he could no longer move his head and no longer speak, I could keep myself in his line of vision and bring the dogs into his line of vision and see a reaction in his eyes that meant that, though he wasn't talking anymore, he knew that we were there with him. And it meant that that I could talk to him as he was going and be inside of that experience with him.
It must have been really good for you to be able to be there like that.
I can't imagine what it would have been like to lose him without being able to participate in that. Because there really was a kind of, oh, this is going to sound odd, there was a kind of beauty, a kind of power about watching that transformation. I don't know what I believe happens to us after we die, but I know now that it's something of which I'm not afraid. And that there is an enormous grace and dignity that becomes visible in us in that moment of our greatest extremity. And having seen that in him, I'm sure is what carried me through the first few months without him. You know, and then after a while, that sense of having been in some way blessed to be with him then, faded, and I was faced with the plain old misery of grief and being without him. But the experience of being a part of that most, in a way, most profound moment in his life carried me through many months.
Mark, how is your health?
Oh, well, as far as I know, I'm fine. When Wally and I took the HIV test in 1989. He tested positive, I tested negative, and I haven't tested again since.
Well, I wish you good health. And
thank you, Terry.
Thank you for reading your wonderful poems for us.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Mark Doty, his latest book of poems, My Alexandria, is published by the University of Illinois Press. Coming up, an AIDS prayer. This is Fresh Air. Playwright Tony Kushner has written what he calls a challenge and a complaint to God. He was asked to write this AIDS prayer by James Morton, Dean of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, an Episcopal church in New York City. Kushner won a Pulitzer Prize for his play Angels in America, which is about being gay in America in the mid-80s during the AIDS epidemic. Angels ends its Broadway run this Sunday. We asked Tony Kushner to read us part of his AIDS prayer.
God, a cure would be nice. rid those infected by this insatiable, unappeasable murderer of its lethal presence. Reconstitute the shattered, restore to health all those whose bodies, beleaguered, have betrayed them, whose defenses have permitted entrance to illnesses formerly at home only in cattle, in swine, and in birds. Return to the cattle, the swine, and the birds, the intestinal parasite, the invader of lungs, the eye blinder, the brain devourer, the detacher of retinas. Rid even the cattle and the birds of these terrors. Heal the whole world. Now, 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 now. Grant us an end that is not fatal. Protect the injection drug user, the baby with AIDS, the sex worker, the woman whose lover was infected, the gay man whose lover was infected. Protect the infected lover. Protect the casual contact, the one-night stand, the pickup, the put-down. Protect the fools who don't protect themselves, who don't protect others. You protect them. The misguided, too, and the misinformed, the ambivalent about living, show them life, not death. The kid who thinks that immortality is part of the numinous glory of sex, who didn't believe this once, discovering sex. Everyone did. Protect this kid. Let this kid learn otherwise and live past the learning. Protect all kids. Make them wiser, but until wise, make them immortal. Enlighten the unenlightened, the Pope, the cardinals, archbishops and priests, even John O'Connor. Teach him how Christ's kindness worked. Remind him he's forgotten. Make them all remember. Replace the ice water in their veins with the blood of Christ. Let it pound in their temples. The insurance executive as well as the priest, the congressional representative, the justice and the judge, the pharmaceutical profiteer, the doctor, the cop, the anchorwoman and the televangelist. Make their heads throb with memory. Make them see with new eyes Christ's wounds as KS lesions, Christ's thin body AIDS thin, his shrunken chest pneumonia deflated, his broken limbs, his pierced hands, stigmata of this unholy plague. Let the spilled blood which angels gathered, Christ's blood, be understood. It is shared and infected blood.
Why do you think the dean of the cathedral asked you, a Jew who sounds like he's not all that sure he believes in God, to write a prayer?
Well, I told him that I was an agnostic, and I'm definitely an agnostic Jew, and it felt very strange to be standing in the pulpit of this immense cathedral preaching to the goyim. But I felt... He had seen Angels in America. He loved it. He thought that the spirituality in the play spoke to him. And it's a very ambiguous, ambivalent spirituality. But he felt that it was there in the play, and I agree with him. I mean, I think that there is part of me and part of a lot of people today. I think people are questing for God or for some sort of spiritual... direction, some sort of spiritual awakening, something that will help to explain the staggering degree of loss we've encountered, and some sense of grandeur and size that goes beyond the quotidian and the material and the selfish. And I think people are looking for something more than that. I think that regardless of what Newt Gingrich is telling us, we're not all selfish. We're not all isolated and lonely and alone. We believe in collectives. We believe in families. We believe in connections between people. And when one starts to investigate such things, I think one winds up thinking about the divine. So I think that he saw those strains in the play and decided that I would be an interesting person to ask.
So, Tony, what's the actual time of the last Broadway performance of Angels?
It's going to be on Sunday. Oh, God, I don't... 1 o'clock, I think, is when it starts. It's totally sold out. It'll close at 4:30 on Sunday.
Are you sad about it closing?
Oh, I'm very sad. I really am very sad. I'm really dreading it. And then I fly off to Tokyo the next day and see it in Tokyo in Japanese. So I think that will be a very interesting experience.
Well, have a good trip.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure.
Tony Kushner, this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today is World AIDS Day, and we're featuring some of the literature about the epidemic. Coming up, we hear more from the poets who have given voice to the grief and anger others find nearly impossible to express. And we'll hear from an editor who's helped shape the literature of AIDS and worked with many writers who have since died of AIDS. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. President Clinton today unveiled a new initiative that he said would improve U.S. military readiness. UPI's Bill Small has the story.
Mr. Clinton announced a five-point plan, which he said was designed to make sure that America's armed forces receive the resources and support they need to maintain a high standard of readiness.
First, I intend to ask Congress to add an additional $25 billion to our planned defense budgets over the next 6 years. Second, I will seek the full pay raise allowed by law for our uniformed military throughout the turn of the century.
Mr. Clinton says he'll also send Congress an emergency supplemental budget request to help cover the military's unanticipated costs of operations in Haiti, the Gulf, and off the former Yugoslavia. Bill Small at the White House.
President Clinton today named retiring Senate Democratic leader George Mitchell as a special economic envoy to Northern Ireland. Meanwhile, British Prime Minister John Major today asked members of Sinn Féin, the IRA's political wing, to meet with senior government officials next week. In his invitation, Major called the talks exploratory and said they'd be a vital step toward peace in Northern Ireland. He said the dialogue depends on Sinn Féin's continued observance of its August ceasefire. It'll be the first time the two sides have openly met since the 1920s when Ireland was divided. British and Sinn Féin officials have met secretly before. Ambassador Robert Gallucci was on Capitol Hill today defending the nuclear agreement he helped negotiate with North Korea. Both Republicans and Democrats on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee are questioning whether the deal benefits the U.S. NPR's Caroline Clark Kelly has more.
Under the accord, North Korea agrees to freeze its entire nuclear program, and in return, the U.S. will pick up the tab for $5 million worth of home heating oil and will help build two new, safer reactors. Virginia Democrat Chuck Robb says some believe the deal represents nuclear blackmail. Republicans on the panel are worried about what happens if North Korea eventually backs out of the agreement. Ambassador Gallucci insists the U.S. still comes out ahead.
If this is 5 or 6 years from now, there would have been no reprocessing, no additional accumulation of plutonium in North Korea. It seems to me that by whatever measure we use, we're much better off if they walk away from the agreement than if we did not have the agreement.
Gallucci told the senators the pact with North Korea achieves more than he thought possible when talks began 16 months ago. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
The Commerce Department says Americans' incomes jumped in October by 1.4% and consumer spending rose by 0.7%. Both increases were stronger than expected. The October numbers led to concern among some analysts that the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates again to cool down the economy and curb inflation. On Wall Street, stocks closed down today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 38.36 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. NATO ministers meeting in Brussels have agreed to a one-year study of how the alliance should expand. In a statement, they said it was premature to discuss when NATO would admit new members. Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, and Slovakia want to join the alliance, and they've pushed for a quick decision. The minister's statement says enlargement would proceed on a case-by-case basis. The document also tries to ease Russian fears about NATO membership for former East Bloc countries. The ministers say enlargement would threaten no one and would enhance European stability and security. Warplanes launched new bombing raids today near the capital of the breakaway Russian Republic of Chechnya. NPR's Anne Garrels reports.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin had issued an ultimatum to the various factions battling for power in his rebellious republic. Lay down your arms or Russia will intervene. The deadline passed, and there are reports this morning of bombing raids in and around the capital city, Grozny. Though the planes are as yet unidentified, they may be the first of what Yeltsin's spokesman today called a series of steps to restore constitutional order and protect human rights in Chechnya. Grozny's been bracing itself for an invasion of Russian forces. Chechnya, a small, oil-rich Caucasian republic, declared itself independent in 1991, a status that Russia has never recognized. After 3 years, Russia appears to be losing patience, and according to reports from the region, Russian troops and armored vehicles have massed along Chechnya's northern border. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
In the Gaza Strip in Jericho, PLO authorities took over tax collection today, further expanding Palestinian self-rule. The new government also receives control of the health system today. The PLO has been in charge of several aspects of government for 6 months, including education, tourism, and welfare. Meanwhile, Israel's police minister today called for the West Bank and Gaza to be sealed off, that after a Palestinian killed a female Israeli soldier yesterday. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this World AIDS Day, we're featuring some of the extraordinary literature that has been written in the wake of the epidemic. Michael Denany says this literature may have no literary parallel. It's as if war poems were being written and mimeographed in the trenches, then distributed to soldiers to read under fire. Denany has edited some of this literature. Many of the writers he's worked with have died of AIDS. Denany was an editor at St. Martin's Press for 17 years, where he had his own gay imprint, Stonewall Editions. He recently moved to Crown. I asked him if the nature of his relationship to a writer changes if that writer gets sick.
It puts you under enormous psychological pressure. I mean, I never would have anticipated 20 years ago going into publishing, constantly worrying about whether I could get a book out before the writer died, which has become a regular problem. Most of the times we make it, but not always. So it puts enormous pressure on the whole process. And then there are, you know, emergencies. I mean, when Randy Schultz was finishing Conduct Unbecoming, he collapsed. Basically, he had almost finished the book, but was immobilized in a hospital for weeks. And I essentially had to fly out there and, with the assistance he'd set up and with his approval, sort of finish the book to get it out in time so that it was relevant to the fairly asinine debate that we had on gays in the military.
Well, it must put you in a funny position because, on the one hand, I know you're probably really close to some of the writers you work with. And as a person close to a writer, you want to urge them to take it easy if they're sick and to not work. And as their editor and as someone who really cares about the body of work they're leaving behind, you want to urge them, finish the book, leave it behind complete if you possibly can.
Well, with the case of Randy, he had basically taken great risks with his health in order to finish this book. He was so committed to finishing the book, it had taken precedence in his thinking over his own health. Or with John Preston last spring, John actually was in a coma for 2 weeks, and I thought that was the end. And suddenly he came out of it, gave me a call, which startled the hell out of me. I said, "John, I never thought I was going to speak to you again." And he said, "I can't die in peace until we get the contract done for Franny," which I thought was a perfect John Preston. I said, "John, you're really pushing it this time." But we had 3 days, and we managed to get all the legal niceties handled. He managed to revise Franny. He signed the contracts and, I believe, died within 8 hours.
Wow.
It was just a stunning event, but clearly he was totally committed to getting this, his favorite book, out in a new edition and in cloth.
Well, I guess there couldn't be a better illustration of how important a writer's work is to them.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever say to one of your writers, "Look, don't worry about the book, take care of your health first"? I mean, which do you feel more loyal to, their health or to their work?
I think basically being loyal to the writers, you have to allow them to make the decision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's generally the case. Various people respond in various ways, even if they're not writers. I mean, you know, some go into a totally health mode. Some would prefer to live their life the way they're living now, even if it would shorten their life. And I think you just have to respect the autonomy of those decisions. If these are your friends, I mean, whether you agree with them or not, who knows what, you know, what one would do in those circumstances oneself. So you sort of, I think the duty of a friend is simply to, or an editor for that matter, is to support the person in whatever decision they make.
Have you been in the position where a writer has died before they were able to complete the book, and then you had to decide what to do with the manuscript?
Yeah, actually one of the most unusual cases that I know of was a guy named Peter McGee, who had written two novels that I had published about AIDS, clearly quite autobiographical. The second novel, actually, he died within a week of getting the contract, so I edited it with his long-term lover, Doug Wilson. And Peter had left two pages of notes behind about the third book in this trilogy he had always intended to write. And to my astonishment, Doug wrote the novel. I thought this was a very bad idea. You know, it just does not sound likely. It doesn't sound like it's going to have a good outcome. Doug had never particularly been a writer, although he'd been Peter's first reader and sort of editor. But he did an incredible job. And it's in Peter's voice. The structure is very similar. It fits into the trilogy beautifully. It's called A Labor of Love, which is perfectly appropriate. And Doug himself died within 5 days of sending me the manuscript.
Oh, wow.
But as a literary event, I've never quite seen something like that. As, you know, sort of the last thing you can do for your lover, you write a novel that finishes his trilogy. It was quite remarkable.
Well, you know how people say doctors shouldn't get too close to their patients, in part because patients sometimes die, and you can't go through that with everyone. You're in that position as an editor now. I mean, you have writers who are dying, and you must ask yourself how close you can allow yourself to get so that you can keep on with your work.
Yeah, but I don't think you can withdraw, especially if, you know, if these are people who have been friends of yours for years. It's just like as if they were friends to begin with. I mean, you can't distance or withdraw from that. You just go through it. I mean, it's part of the bad times we're living in, I guess. It does get wearing. It does get wearing. I actually edited Randy Schultz's second book, Band Played On, which was all about AIDS, almost entirely in a hospital room. One of my ex-lovers was dying, and I made a deal with the nurses at Roosevelt, I guess visiting hours were over at 8:30, and he didn't like to be alone. So I made a deal with the nurses that if I got in before 8:30, I could stay till 1 or 2. And since he was comatose most of the time, I figured, you know, I could edit there as well as I could edit at home, and then I would be there if he woke up. But I must admit, after about 7 weeks, it was really getting me down.
Well, I'm sure that's a remarkable understatement, that it was getting you down.
Yeah, it was like everywhere you turned.
Your lover, the book you were editing, all about AIDS.
Mm-hmm. It was a grim time.
What do you think the place of AIDS literature will be after the epidemic?
I think it'll probably be the founding literature of gay culture and the gay community in a very odd way. I mean, in the 70s, when I first got involved in publishing, you know, gay books, gay magazines, etc., there were many heated discussions about whether there was such a thing as gay culture or not. I mean, even by people who today would be considered representatives of gay culture, like Edmund White or Ethan Mordden, there are many late-night discussions where even those guys sometimes took the position that there was no such thing as a specifically gay culture or gay literature. I don't think that will be a position many people will take 10 years from now. And to some extent, I think because this historical event, or the you know, this historical threat to the whole community so mobilized the resources of the writers, and they did create this literature, which I think is quite remarkable. I think they sort of put that, made that a moot question.
Michael Denneny is an editor at Crown Books. This is Fresh Air. Writers who die of AIDS sometimes leave their unfinished work in the hands of trusted friends. Poet David Trinidad is co-editing a volume of poems by his friend Tim Dugos, who died of AIDS in 1990. Dugos was a contributing editor of the gay paper Christopher Street. We invited David Trinidad to read a poem by Dugos called DOA.
DOA. You knew who I was when I walked in the door. You thought that I was dead. Well, I am dead. A man can walk and talk and even breathe and still be dead. Edmund O'Brien is perspiring and chewing up the scenery in my favorite film noir, DOA. I can't stop watching, can't stop relating. When I walked down Columbus to Endicott last night to pick up Tor's new novel, I felt the eyes of every Puerto Rican teen, crackhead, yuppie couple focus on my cane and makeup. You're dead, they seem to say in chorus. Somewhere in a dark bar years ago, I picked up luminous poisoning. My eyes glowed as I sipped my drink. After that, there was no cure, no turning back. I had to find out what was gnawing at my gut. The hardest parts, not even the physical effects, stumbling like a drunk, Edmund O'Brien was one of Hollywood's most active lushes, through 40 sets, alternating sweats and fevers, reptilian spots on face and scalp. It's having to say goodbye, like the scene where soundtrack violins go crazy as O'Brien gives his last embrace to his girlfriend come Girl Friday, Paula, played by Pamela Britton. They're filmdom's least likely lovers. The squat and jowly alky and the homely, fundamentally talentless actress who would hit the height of her fame as the pillhead acting landlady on My Favorite Martian 15 years in the future. I don't have 15 years, and neither does Edmund O'Brien. He has just enough time to tell Paula how much he loves her, then to drive off in a convertible for the showdown with his killer. I'd like to have a showdown, too, if I could figure out which pistol-packing, brilliant-teened, and ruthless villain in a houndstooth overcoat took my life. Lust, addiction, being in the wrong place at the wrong time? That's not the whole story. Absolute fidelity to the truth of what I felt, open to the moment, and in every case a kind of love. All of the above brought me to this tottering, self-conscious state. Pneumonia, emaciation, grisly cancer, no future, heart of gold, passionate engagement with a great B film, a glorious summer afternoon in which to pick up the ripest plum tomatoes of the year and prosciutto for the feast I'll cook tonight for the man I love, phone calls from my friends, and a walk to the park, ignoring stares to clear my head. A day like any, like no other. Not so bad for the dead.
That's a wonderful poem.
Yeah.
Would you tell us why you like it so much?
Well, I think that it combines several things. You know, not only the autobiographical material and the fact of Tim's illness, but also his love of popular culture and movies, which occurs throughout his work, you know, from the very beginning.
That's a love you share.
And, yes.
Because you write a lot about that in your poems, too.
Yes. And in fact, Tim was very influential, had a big influence on me at the beginning. And I think he was one of the poets who really got me in touch with my love of popular culture and got me into writing about it.
Now, there's a poem of yours I'd like to hear, and it's a poem about Tim. And it's called Driving Back from New Haven. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the circumstances that you wrote this poem.
I wrote the poem Driving Back from New Haven in 1988. I had just moved to New York from Los Angeles, and Tim had just moved from New York to New Haven, where he was enrolled in the Yale Divinity School. And he drove me up to New Haven and showed me around and then drove me back to Manhattan. And this is about the trip back to Manhattan. Driving back from New Haven. Tim looks at his watch, reaches into his pocket, takes out a small plastic container, and swallows an AZT pill with a sip of Sprite. Poison, he mutters under his breath. I glance over at him. We haven't talked about his health the entire trip. How does it make you feel, I ask. Like I want to live until they discover a cure, he snaps. We travel in silence for a while. I stare out the window at all the green trees on the Merritt Parkway. Then he says, I resent it. I resent that we were not raised with an acceptance of death, and here it is, all around us, and I resent it. I resent that we do not know how to die.
Do you remember what you said to Tim after he said that?
You know, I don't, and I'm pretty sure that that's a pretty accurate description of what we talked about. But when I showed it, I sent it off to Tim after I wrote it with a note saying, please like this. and he responded and said that he did indeed like the poem, which was a relief. And I think he was surprised. I remember him saying that he was surprised that he was so angry or sounded so angry in the poem.
How much of your writing has been about AIDS?
Very little, actually. This is one of the few poems I have that where I directly address it. I think it sort of seeps between the lines in ways that I don't even know about. But it's a very painful subject, and I've lost many friends and peers to AIDS. So I don't think it's something that I've, you know, fully explored yet in my own work.
Is it a subject you just as soon not write about and that you feel is being well-served already?
Partially, yes. I feel that there are many poets who have been sick, who have written about it, or who have lost lovers, you know, and written about that, the pain of that loss. I just assume that someday I probably will write about it, but it's just too painful to tackle yet.
David Trinidad, his poem Driving Back from New Haven is included in his latest book, Answer Song, published by High Risk. Trinidad and Dennis Cooper are editing a collection of poems by their late friend Tim Dugos. It will include the poem DOA. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Andy Bowers reports from a NATO meeting in Brussels. The diplomats there are talking about difficulties with Russian leaders over NATO's future. Mara Liasson has a story from Washington on recent differences between President Clinton and the incoming Senate leader, Robert Dole. Bob Mondello reports on two old movies made in the 1940s by the Public Health Service about sexually transmitted diseases, a commentary from a college student about World AIDS Day, and I'll talk with Hazel Dickens, a folk singer, about the passing of Nimrod Workman, a coal miner and singer. He was 99 years old.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We close our World AIDS Day program with the writing of Essex Hempel, a poet who has written about being black and gay and has edited anthologies of African-American gay poets. He's going to read a piece he wrote in June 1993 after he discovered how low his T-cell count had fallen. T-cells are white blood cells that protect the blood from infection. This is an excerpt of Vital Signs.
Some of the T-cells I am without are not here through my own fault. I didn't lose all of them foolishly, and I didn't lose all of them erotically. Some of the missing T-cells were lost to racism, a well-known transmittable disease. Some were lost to poverty because there was no money to do something about the plumbing before the pipes burst and the room flooded. Homophobia killed quite a few, but so did my rage and my pointed furies. So did the wars at home and the wars within. So did the drugs I took to remain calm, cool, collected. There are T-cells lying dead by the roadside, slain by the guise of friendship, the pettiness and jealousy of minds and talent in the process of wasting to nothingness due to envy, gazing into other yards instead of looking closely at and tending to their own. There are T-cells sacrificed between the love and anger my mother and I hold for one another, T-cells that have simply exploded due to the decibel of our screeching. There are countless wasted T-cells between my father and I, the result of painful subterranean silences that I cannot resolve with only 23 T-cells, nor should I really be expected to, nor should I try, since it was his violence I witnessed and remained scarred from. I am forced to remember him in certain ways, to always see him punching and pushing, slapping and yelling, not because I want to, I just haven't learned how to make so many scars into things of beauty, and I don't know if I ever will.
I'm interested in the ending of that passage about making scars into things of beauty. Do you feel like in confronting AIDS, this is what you should really be trying to do, is to reconcile with people and to make scars into things of beauty?
In some ways, I've been faced with that. In some ways, I allow that you cannot revisit some sites, some emotional sites, some personal sites. Some things will forever be the tragedies, big and small, that they were. The only thing I do know is that forgiving is as divine as saying thanks. I am sure of that. So I get up every day thankful, you know, just thankful.
Essex Hempel, a book of his writing called Ceremonies, is published by Plume Books. We'll continue to feature writers who are chronicling the AIDS epidemic on future programs. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our World AIDS Day program was produced by Phyllis Myers with Joan Tuohy and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.